I'm Christopher Busby. I've been working on the health effects of low-level radiation since 1992, and I formed, or at least I'm a scientific secretary of an outfit called the European Committee on Radiation Risk. I've written two books on the subject of internal ionizing radiation. I have taken issue with the current radiation risk model of the International Commission on Radiological Protection, the one that's used to underpin all of the radiation laws for exposure in the West anyway. I have made a particular study of uranium and the health effects of uranium, which are very, very serious and anomalous and not modeled properly at all by the authorities, which enables them to continue to use depleted uranium and other uranium weapons in various places, including Iraq, which I visited with radiation detection equipment, and also the Balkans, which I also visited in 2001 with radiation equipment. So basically, I'm a uranium and health expert and epidemiologist and physical chemist.
You're out in, is it Latvia now?
Yes, I'm in Latvia now.
Do you want to explain why you're out there?
Well, I might say because I like it, and because it's I've been living here on and off since 2010. Well, it's a very beautiful country, and it was very cheap to live in, and I've been able to acquire very cheaply a lot of forest and a house, and so I live in the forest and the house, and also because I'm afraid I think that I'm a bit of a target for the bad guys, you know, the nuclear military complex, because I've taken a lot of court cases against them and I'm winning various battles against them in the scientific literature. So especially since my boss, who I worked with in America, has been killed, or at least has suddenly died unexpectedly, I've always been for the last 10 years a little bit nervous about the idea of my being sort of quietly bumped off.
Okay, so who was that? Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Stuart Smith. I mean, in 2004, I was contacted by Stuart Smith. You can find him on the internet, except he's dead now. He's a very, very famous and rich United States attorney from New Orleans. And he was mainly responsible for suing Exxon and various other oil companies in relation to their contamination of the environment with radium from oil wells. And also he took on BP over the big oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Remember, there was this enormous explosion on an oil platform there. And so he got a lot of money for the fishermen and various other people who were contaminated by the oil. And he took on the case relating to the opioids, where mothers of children were given opioids for painkillers, and the children then were born with a load of birth defects. And I was involved in that case, and I think probably I helped him win it. And so that case was a very, very big case against some very big dogs. And so generally he takes on big dogs. And then we had four court cases going in America couple of years ago. I'd worked with him on that for about 4 years, or longer for those cases. These were cases in St. Louis, Missouri, and in Ohio, at the Portsmouth radiation plant there, where they make enriched uranium there. Various other uranium factories and production sites and tips in America, which we were winning, and I was working with him on that. And at the end of it, he decided to take a case against the U.S. government based on my work, which shows that the radiation protection laws are dishonestly put together and are quite wrong. And shortly after that, he suddenly died.
So how old was he?
60. Mind you, he wasn't well. I mean, he developed cancer some years before then, but then that was cured. And then what happened is, towards the end of the COVID, he had a place in Paris. I used to go to see him in Paris, because I've got a boat in France, an old barge, and so I used to visit him a lot in Paris. He was a good friend of mine too. And suddenly he was in Paris, and he got ill and was taken into hospital and was put on life support. But it wasn't COVID. It was some sort of strange lung disease, which nobody really understood. But he recovered from that. And then later he died of a heart attack. He was on the phone to me when he was having the heart attack. Actually, I was having a talk with him at the time, and we were discussing what we were going to do about this court case where we were taking on the US government under the Fifth Amendment to show that the risk model had been constructed capriciously and, you know, dishonestly. But anyway, he didn't last. So, incidentally, by the way, that meant that all of the assistance he had given me, funding the European Committee on Radiation Risk, he funded a big meeting in Greece in 2010 or 2012, I think it was. He paid out. He's a very rich man. He was a billionaire, and he made a lot of money out of suing Exxon and Mobil and all these companies, these oil companies. And I worked with him on all of those cases. He wasn't very keen, I have to say. He wasn't very keen on my connection with the Russians. He said that if I had to go into court in America as an expert witness, which I had done, and we'd won lots and lots of cases, long going right back to 2004, but he said because of my connection with Putin, well, of course I don't have a connection with Putin, but the fact that I was used to do some articles for Russia Today, he said that wouldn't go down well in America, and they would attack me about that in the witness box, and so I would be sort of like discredited. I think right, he's so probably
you,
right.
You'd be sort of election fixer. Only thing is, the Russians did not fix the American elections.
No, of course. But the problem is with the American media is that the Russians have been, you know, basically dismissed as monsters, and anyone who has an interview with them is automatically a monster.
Exactly the same in Britain. Is it the same in Latvia? Because you're right.
Oh, it's much worse in Latvia. Goodness me, it's much worse in Latvia. In Latvia, if you say, I mean, you can be arrested for saying anything good about the Russians in Latvia. You can end up in jail.
So you could go to jail. Sounds a bit like China. You know, you could go to jail for having a Putin T-shirt, like you could in Beijing for walking down the street with a "I don't agree with Xi" T-shirt. This sort of thing.
No, that's quite right. Lots of especially kids, you know, have been, because there are a lot of Russians in Latvia. That's the point. A lot of Russian speakers in Latvia, but maybe 40% of the population of Latvia are Russian speaking. And I've got many friends who are Russian speaking. In fact, I'm beginning to be Russian speaking as well. But it's not a good thing in Latvia. Latvia's become not just Latvia, but even worse is Estonia. But the Baltic states, who incidentally have a total population approximately equal to Greater Manchester, so we're not talking about a lot of people here, but they've become very, very right-wing and hysterical about Russia. Of course, it's good for them because the armies of the West then come here, and we have a lot of people driving around in tanks with Latvian flags and, you know, basically saying that if the Russians come here, they'll kill them and so forth. Of course, the Russians have no desire whatever to come to Latvia, I don't think. But the things are getting worse and worse and worse, so it's possible. I mean, I was thinking about the Ukrainian war recently and where it was going, because clearly, you know, the Ukrainians have lost the war. They've had all their soldiers have been killed. And even if they get given lots and lots of guns and ammunition and tanks and what have you, F-16 fighters and so forth from America, they don't have anyone to operate them. So the question is, then, what is Putin going to do? Well, Putin cannot possibly leave them be. Otherwise, it would be just a continuous sort of like terrorist situation, a bit like the Israelis in Gaza. So the whole thing is descending into a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, well, we've lost Henry Kissinger this week, the only person who's been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, who's also managed to kill about at least 3 million people in wars. But he was, one of those people who was trying to bring about peace, actually, in Ukraine. He said, look, this is getting really stupid. Just draw a line where the Russians are now and let's stop there and finish the whole thing.
Yes, but anybody with one brain cell can see that. You don't have to be Kissinger. I mean, I gave a talk at the Nobel Peace Institute long ago I was invited to go and talk about uranium there, and I went there, Oslo it is, where they give the peace prizes. And so I stood in the lectern where you get the peace prize, and some old girl came up and gave me some flowers, and I went and sat in the room where they award the peace prize, where the committee sits there, and I sat in there before they threw me out. And I have to say that all the peace prize recipients, that all pictures of them all around the wall, including Kissinger, were all monsters and nutcases. I mean, there wasn't a single person there that I would have given a peace prize to in a million years. They were all bastards, all of them, whole lot.
So what's going on with that then?
With what? Going on with what?
So what's going on with this Nobel Peace Prize?
Oh Lord, it's a political thing. It's like the Eurovision Song Contest, you know. It's like that. It's highly politicized. It's just goodness me, they gave the peace prize to Obama and he hadn't done anything at all. All he'd become the president, and they gave him the peace prize. It's like the Eurovision Song Contest. You will notice, or at least somebody told me, it may not be true, that the Eurovision Song Contest this year was won by a Ukrainian.
Yeah, your work is in low-level radiation, in looking at the risk model, this kind of thing. Obviously, in the West, and you told us many times before, the risk model here is completely wrong. Actually, the explosion in cancer since World War II may well be largely due to things like nuclear atmospheric testing, the current use of nuclear power, all sorts of reasons. Now, but what's the regime like over the other side of the border there, east of you in Russia?
The Russians take the view, I mean, they don't really have a risk model in that sense. So they have various laws about exposure, but they're much more pragmatic about it. I've talked to a number of Russians. I had a number of Russians on the European Committee on Radiation Risk, in fact, quite a few of them, and Belarusians and Ukrainians. And their view is that the Western risk model is wrong, but they need to have nuclear power. It keeps them warm, and so too bad, you know. That's a sort of Stalinist pragmatic view of politics. So you say, well, we have this stuff, you know, and we make bombs to defend ourselves, and we use nuclear power to keep ourselves warm and so forth. And the downstream effects of that, well, too bad. I have to say that if you take the Russian nuclear testing, which mostly took place in Kazakhstan, well, not Russian, Soviet nuclear testing that they did in Kazakhstan, it's had a profound effect on the people living in Kazakhstan. Of course, they killed them all. They all have sort of short lives, and they all die of cancer, and the children are deformed and all the rest of it that you would expect, that I say about the nuclear test veterans. But what the Russians have done there is that anyone who lived near the test sites is given a pension. So they concede that these people have been affected by the testing, and they give them a pension. It's not an awful lot, but it's something. It's like 40 euros a month or something like that for their life. So they concede that these things are dangerous. In the West, what they do, and in fact, I've done a lot of court cases for nuclear test veterans over here, and they just stick in a judge who's dodgy. And I had a whole load of judges who are dodgy, and they just say, oh, no, well, this is all nonsense. Your name's Busby. We know that you tell lies. You're just a crook. Thank you very much. And we're not giving a pension. And that's what they do. It's absolutely disgraceful what they do here. The legal system here, when it comes to anyone exposed to radiation, is just a joke.
We had a ex-Russian colonel, who's still a reserve colonel in the army, on the show last week, talking about Russian nuclear weapons, saying that actually, if it really came to it, the Russians could hit the Yellowstone volcano, which is a super volcano, and kill hundreds of thousands of people in the States, because it's if it were to erupt, it would be incredibly devastating around whole zone. And he's also said that the Russians, they now have these underwater like submarine nukes that they could use to have massive tsunamis on all of the coastal cities on the United States.
Well, of course, I know about that. I mean, the most reasonable one is to detonate a nuclear weapon under the sea and then produce a tsunami and wipe out all the coastal. I mean, most people on land masses live near the coast. So you've got New York and Charleston and Washington. So they could do all of that. And the Americans could do lots of stuff as well. And in fact, Russia has developed these high speed missiles. You know, the ones that go so fast that there's no way they can intercept them. So if it comes to that, they can wipe out America. The problem is that the Americans don't really realize that, and they've never really been involved in a shooting war. So all the populations of Europe, you know, went through the Second World War, they went through the First World War. They kind of know what it's all about. But the Americans don't know what it's all about. So you can have a load of gung-ho individuals in the United States bureaucracy, in the political bureaucracy, who can say, well, we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to wipe out Putin and all the rest of it. They have no real grip on reality. It's all terrifying.
Trying to be realistic about all this, I mean, you're sitting there in the freezing weather now with snow falling maybe around you, certainly loads of ice, minus temperatures in Latvia. But if this was to happen, obviously there'd be lots and lots of people fried. But soon after, they would kick in a thing called a nuclear winter. Have you any idea what that would look like? Because they're supposed to be pretty devastating.
Yes. I've looked at this nuclear winter theory, and frankly, I don't buy it. I've looked at the studies. I've looked at what those people said and what they wrote and really, I don't think that there is going to. There will be a sort of nuclear winter, but it won't be the sort of thing that they're describing, where everything will die and that's the end of everything and so forth. And I can tell you why, because if you take a reasonable approximation to a nuclear exchange between, say, Russia and America, the warheads now are not very big, they're much more deadly. So if you take the total number of megatonnage that will go off bang, okay, in fact, it's not really a lot greater than the total megatonnage that went off bang in the nuclear testing between 1959 and 1963. That period, 1959 and 1963, saw an absolute orgy of nuclear testing by more or less everybody. So all of the nuclear nations were blowing up bombs in the atmosphere all over the place, and that stuff was going all into the stratosphere. I've done a huge amount of studies relating to this because of the nuclear test veterans. I've done a lot of court cases with test veterans, including the big one with Rosenblatt's, the one that then collapsed eventually because it went to the High Court and the High Court squashed it and said that it was too far, you know, that the statute of limitations stopped them from doing it. So a lot of people caught a cold over that. But as a result of it, I got to see nearly every piece of information relating to nuclear testing that is in existence, apart from a few things that the military held secret. And even some of those things I managed to get out of them on some kind of basis that I didn't tell anybody about it. Had to sign the Official Secrets Act and so forth. So I've looked at this quite closely, and I don't believe that the nuclear winter thing stands up. There was a sort of nuclear winter in 1959 to 63. It was very cold, much colder than normal because it was blotting out the sun, just like the nuclear winter guys are arguing. But it lasted about 2 years, and everything was still growing. It just meant it was colder than usual. So there we are. So I don't think that's the problem.
Well, I mean, I think in a way you've argued against yourself there, because the nuclear winter people are saying, well, if there was a massive nuclear exchange, the temperature could go down sort of 20 degrees Celsius right across the world. So it wouldn't completely kill everything, everybody. And then after about 4 or 5 years, it would start returning to normal. In a way, you've just said that because of the tests in the 1950s, that almost proves that if there was a real big nuclear exchange, that it would be something similar, but a lot more, like the Swedes. Yeah. I think it's
Tony, this is quantitative. I mean, we're talking quantitative. I mean, the actual number of megatons exploded in 59 to 63 was not a lot different from the total number of megatons that would be exploded in a nuclear exchange between Russia and America. That's my point. It might be twice or three times, but it's not sort of 100 times. So there will be a nuclear winter, but it will vary with latitude, of course. So people up here will be a lot colder, and people in England will be a lot colder, but people in France and in Spain and all around there will not be so cold that plants won't grow and everybody will starve and so forth. I mean, the sort of interrelationship of of the world, the kind of like connections that there are between all the countries of the world now, are already at a point where they're a little bit, you know, a little bit on the edge of breaking. So what we have now, we don't need a nuclear winter. We're going to have some sort of disastrous development in terms of energy costs and food costs and all the rest of it. We're seeing them now. It's like boiling the frog. You can look at it now. You can see people hiding in doorways and sort of wrapped up in sleeping bags, and people are dying. Make no mistake, they're dying. And at the same time, we've got these climate change situation where you don't have as much production in countries because the countries are becoming too hot. You know, the equatorial countries and the tropical countries are becoming too hot. So all the trees, you know, olive trees, for example, are dying. I was in southern Italy about 2 years ago with Smith, and the olive trees were dead. So now the price of olive oil is going through the roof and so on. So the general disaster scenario, the sort of science fiction disaster scenario, we are already in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you and I both used to be, well, I suppose we are still part of the environmental movement. We'll be talking about COP in a minute. But the reason we were chatting about a week ago was because of this enormous explosion of an arms dump in Ukraine hit by the Russians. And you were talking at the time about I think it was gamma radiation being detected across Europe and Germany in a plume, so potentially depleted uranium or other sorts of weapons in there that went up. Now I know you've been crunching the numbers on this since. What have you found?
Right, well, what I've been able to do is to use the United States NOAA, the National Oceanic and Aeronautic Agency computer. They have a computer that uses that can take historic archived weather data for more or less any date and any time. So you can go back any date and any time. I've done a lot of this stuff in the past, so I know how to do it. And you use this computer program to plot the track of the plume. So there's a huge bang, and there's a lot of pictures on the internet of this explosion, which throws a big black cloud up to 1,000 feet or more. Where does it go?
Down a little bit. It was Khmelnytsky, I think, wasn't it? What was that?
Yes, yes. It's Khmelnytsky, and it's between sort of southeast of. No, southwest. It's sort of southwest of Kiev, but before about halfway between Kiev and the border with Poland. That's where it is. So anyway, this thing went bang, and the Russians said that it was a uranium dump. Storage for the depleted uranium weapons that everybody agreed had been sent to Russia for use sent to Ukraine for use against the Russians. These are shells. That was the story. That's the discourse. And so the Russians popped a missile into it, and the whole lot of them went up in the air. Bang! It was an enormous explosion, and it was detected at an earthquake seismic center about 50 miles or so northwest of the explosion site. So we know exactly when it happened.
So we're talking about 15th of May, 14th of May.
2023 13th of May at 4 o'clock in the morning.
And local people talked about it as a massive mushroom blast, and the whole area shook.
Yes, that's right. Well, it was detected at 3.4 on the Richter scale at this earthquake site, and also pictures from satellites showed that the crater was about 700 meters across, almost a kilometer across. So you're talking about a big bang. So what I did was I put all this data into the computer system and tracked the plume. The plume goes northwest to Poland and southeastern Belarus, right on the corner there. So it's more or less the junction of Belarus and Poland. And then it went right across Poland, and then it hit another pressure system, and it went northeast. So it went into Kaliningrad and up to the Baltics and right up to Norway, in fact. and to St. Petersburg too. So it went, so it sort of zigzag, went up and then it went across. But the important thing is that the detectors, there's a European detector network that was set up after Chernobyl so that we didn't get surprised by another nuclear accident. And this detected the gamma radiation peak as it crossed the detectors. The nearest detectors were just on the border with Poland, and they showed a peak, and the peak was about 32 nanosieverts per hour. They measure the dose rate, and the dose rate peak was about 30 to 35 nanosieverts per hour. So we know what the radiation was, the gamma radiation. Now, everybody says, or at least, you know, it's generally argued that uranium is not a gamma emitter, which it isn't. But it does have a daughter called thorium-234 and another one called protoactinium-234M. And both of those are weak, very, very weak gamma emitters, but they are gamma emitters. So if you have a lot of uranium, you'll see the gamma radiation from the gamma emitters. Now, there's a and I've done a lot of this as well. There are a number of ways in which you can convert gamma radiation back into the activity of the material. So you say so many nanosieverts per hour equals so many becquerels per cubic meter. And this is a lot of clever stuff that's been done by the United States Environmental Protection Agency. And they published in 1978, I think, thereabouts, a big list of tables that enable you to do this. So I did that. So that enabled me to show that if it was uranium, and I have to say if it was uranium at this point, there were about 6,000 becquerels per kilogram per cubic meter. So we had the concentration of the uranium in the cloud at that point on the border. Now we know it was a uranium because we detected it in the filters of the Atomic Energy Authority in Aldermaston. So when I looked at the Aldermaston records, which I got under the Freedom of Information Act, they showed that there was a big spike in uranium in their filters just after this explosion. So this is a sort of Sherlock Holmesian thing. So we know it's uranium, and we know that what the gamma radiation is, and from the EPA tables we can tell how much uranium there was at the border. And now those detectors were 400 kilometers away from the site, from the Khmelnytsky site. So what can we do with that? Well, we can do a Gaussian plume model reverse situation. So we can look at the, if we know how much radiation there is 400 kilometers away, we can work out how much radiation, how much material is in the source. So we've got the amount of uranium in the cloud 400 kilometers away. We work backwards using a model developed by the National Radiological Protection Board in England, which I've also used quite a lot in court cases, generally accepted to be pretty accurate. And we track it back to Khmelnytsky, and we find that the amount of uranium involved was 50 tons. So that's the answer to all of these questions. When you put all this mathematics together and you shake it, what pops out is 50 tons of uranium. Now, is that a lot of uranium? I think it is a lot of uranium.
Well, hang on, Chris, because actually uranium is it's a heavy metal, of course. If you were to pick it up, you would think, gosh, this stuff's incredibly heavy. So maybe it's not quite so much.
Oh, well, I'm not interested in the volume. I'm interested in the mass, because we know what the bullets, the shells. I mean, these are depleted uranium shells. They have a rod of uranium down the middle of them, and they were given by United Kingdom to Russia, not to Russia, to Ukraine. And so we can work out how many shells are involved. And the answer is because the weight of each shell in terms of uranium, not in terms of the shells, but in terms of uranium, is between 3 and 5 kilograms. Of uranium.
So just to make it clear, this stuff is actually nuclear waste, isn't it?
Yes, it's nuclear waste. I mean, if they didn't, and I have a bit more to say on that, incidentally, but if they didn't give it away and use it in shells, then they would have to dispose of it in America, and that would in sort of all sorts of special landfills with signs saying no entry and so forth, because it's dangerous stuff and it's not allowed to get into the groundwater and so forth. So it would cost them a lot of money to dispose of it. But of course, it doesn't cost them anything to dispose of it if they just make it into a rod and shoot it at somebody, because then it contaminates somebody else's country. And so it's an easy way of getting rid of their nuclear waste. And that's something also which I want to talk about relating to various different nuclear weapons that it might be. But to go back to the shells, if each shell is 5 kilograms, then we've got 50 tons, you've got 10,000 shells. Now, is that a lot? I think it is a lot. If it's 3 kilograms, you've got more like 16,000 shells. But I don't know. I'm not an expert on how many shells they need, how many bullets they need for their cannons. And maybe that is the amount that they were given. But the other explanation is that there's something else there, which is not shells. And I think there's a whole range. This is my understanding, having thought about this a lot, especially since Gaza and Iraq and so forth, you know. I think that they have, and also Kosovo. I mean, I was in Kosovo looking at the results of missile attacks by the United States on the Kosovan positions in Pristina, the Yugoslavian Defense Force. And I saw a hole in it. There was a 9-10 story building, reinforced concrete building. That's how they build them out. The Soviet idea. Your floors are made of reinforced concrete. The whole thing is made of reinforced concrete. Anyway, I was there, and there was a missile had come through this thing to blow it up, and it had gone through 9 floors of reinforced concrete. I mean, quite neatly, like somebody had put a needle there. There was a hole, then a hole, then a hole, then a hole, then a hole, sort of diagonally going across this sort of 3-dimensional chess problem building, which was the post office building, in fact, originally. And so they attacked it. So something had gone through all that concrete, and I don't think a normal missile would have done that. It would have had to have some ability to pierce 9 floors of reinforced concrete. So I think that they've been using uranium inside missiles and bombs, as well as using them.
Just be clear about this. Normally, a missile will detonate. The charge will detonate on it as soon as it hits something hard, like a piece of reinforced concrete, won't it? It won't just carry on.
No, well, it will if it's been designed as a bunker buster, you know, because around about that time they were developing what they call bunker busters. I mean, honestly, these monkeys, but still. Anyway, they have this thing called a bunker buster. And of course, it's got to bust a bunker. It's got to go through all the concrete. I mean, you know.
Yeah. So when it hits something, you don't want it to detonate. You want it to just carry on. Especially if it's going with the kinetic energy, it can actually smash its way through.
Well, I have no doubt they've got some clever monkeys that can figure out how to do that. You know, so basically, it has a uranium rod, and all the explosive part of it is somewhere else, right behind the uranium rod, or sort of hidden somewhere. I mean, goodness knows. You know, you can think about it. And when it gets through everything into wherever it's going, it goes bang and kills everybody inside the bunker. I mean, my friend Di Williams knows much more about this, and he's sort of fascinated by all these weapons. And he can show you a whole load of patents for different kinds of bunker busters and weapons that will do this and that and the other. They're all there on the internet. And so he'll even give you the names of them, you know, GBU-3 and PQRST and so forth. I mean, I find it all rather sickening. So apart from the kind of, you know,
but
what
your
happens
thing is, you're doing this analysis to get back to Khmelnytsky. What other potential is there of what was in, if it wasn't just DU shells sitting there, you know, bits of old British and American nuclear waste? That's the U-238 that's been extracted from the U-235, which they want for the nuclear weapons and for the power stations. This nuclear waste in those shells, what else might have been in that massive dump then?
Well, first of all, let's get rid of one thing, and that is say that it wasn't a nuclear explosion, I don't believe, not a conventional nuclear explosion, and I don't think that there was stored nuclear waste there, because if there had been, then the radiation measurements would have been much, much higher. But what we do know is that there did seem to be some residual radiation at the site, because the Ukrainians, when they went in there to clean it all up, they used robots. So they didn't go, people didn't go in there. They had these German robots that they developed after Chernobyl to clear this stuff away without anyone being exposed. So I think certainly what was left behind was radioactive. But of course, it could have just been the uranium, and they didn't want to go in there and inhale the particles or get hit by the gamma radiation from the thorium-230 and so on. Now, as far as so there could have been bombs. They could have been uranium bombs. They could have been uranium missiles. They could have had hard targeting missiles, you know, like the one I'm talking about, the one that I assumed happened in Kosovo. But then, of course, they could have also had something that I would like to talk about briefly, which is a new type of weapon altogether, which is a neutron bomb. And I've been onto this now since 2006 or 2007, this thing, and I'm pretty sure they're using it in Gaza. But we don't know. The trouble is, I put inside my paper what I call a Rumsfeld matrix. You remember that Rumsfeld had all sorts of ideas about what they knew about weapons of mass destruction. And he famously said, you know, we know what we know. We know what we don't know. But we don't know what we don't know, if you see what I mean. So in other words, there are things that can be out there that they haven't even thought about. And that's an important point. And so I put that into there because all I can do and all I did in this study is I made the assumption that we're dealing with U-238. But of course, and then I made the assumption that the U-238, or at least I concluded that U-238 was 50 tons. So further than that, I mean, we can't go. We can just speculate about maybe there's a different kind of weapon that contains uranium. And on that topic, there is a different kind of weapon that contains uranium. And what it does is it generates or is made of uranium-235. So it's enriched uranium. And so that could have been something stored there. Who knows? I know that the Russians were very, very concerned for a long time about Zelensky using a dirty bomb. And so it could be that there's something there that they consider would leave a signature.
Is there any way to tell if it's 238 or 235 in the plume?
Yes, of course, but nobody's done it. The thing is that what I need, I mean, I can do it. And other people can do it, and I've no doubt other people have done it, but they're not telling us, is that you need to go there with a gamma spectrometer, with a portable gamma spectrometer, and then you can measure it. It's not difficult. You can measure the U-235 and U-234 ratio, and that tells you whether it's enriched and how enriched it is, and if there's anything else there nasty, like cobalt-60 or calcium-45 or zinc-65 or any of these substances that are created by neutron activation. They'll find those as well. Gamma spectrometry is a fantastically easy and very powerful method, and it's not expensive. It's not really expensive. I mean, if you have a proper lab which does it, you have to pay them about £200-300 to per sample. But you can. But people have primitive ones. They have an uncooled gamma radiation systems. You know, gamma spectrometers, which cost about £5,000. I've got one. Well,
maybe we should have a call for volunteers with their radiation suit to take their gamma spectrometer in there.
But Tony, nobody's going to let anybody in there. I mean, please. What I'm talking about is probably the biggest secret, the biggest open secret of the last 50 years.
I mean, that explosion is a very interesting event back in May because, you know, one can imagine the Russian thinking behind this is thinking that this DU nuclear waste from places like Hinkley and, you know, wherever in the UK from Sellafield, I suppose, a lot of it separated out, etc. But this stuff may be heading our way, hitting the east of Ukraine. We'd rather blow it to kingdom come. And they probably were looking at the weather pattern to think, well, this is actually going to head west away from us now.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, but just to make it perfectly clear, this is uranium material before it gets anywhere near a bomb or a nuclear reactor. So it's nothing like stuff at Sellafield or Hinkley or any of those things. This is the source material for nuclear. And so it doesn't contain cesium or strontium or plutonium or any of that stuff. OK, this is just uranium. And it may be enriched uranium, so it could be U-235 enriched uranium, but basically it doesn't contain any serious gamma emitters.
Right, so that's the stuff that starts to appear once it's been into a nuclear power station.
Yes, correct. That's after it's fissioned, after the neutrons have got to work and it's fissioned. And so then you get and then fission means the uranium atom has split, and when it splits it gives all this stuff like cesium-137, strontium-90, krypton-85, xenon-13. There's a whole list of these things. And so if you're one of these people who was a test veteran, you know, when they exploded those bombs in the atmosphere, all of that stuff came down over Christmas Island, for example. And they got contaminated with it all. And when Chernobyl went up, all that stuff came over here, and people got contaminated. And that was stuff that happened after it was used in a nuclear power station or a nuclear bomb. This is stuff that is before a nuclear power station and a nuclear bomb. This is just the stuff you dig out of the ground, you refine it, and you turn it into metal, and then you put it in a shell so that it penetrates a tank. Although I have to say there's something else about it too, which I can talk about briefly. Okay, so that's the situation. So we know where it went. We know it went over Poland, mainly over Poland and Western Ukraine. The wind was blowing away from Ukraine, so it went over Western Ukraine and Poland, mainly. Those are the people that caught the plume. And that plume density is not a lot different from, if you divide it by the surface area of Poland, or if you like, the surface area of where it went in Poland, which is about a third of Poland, your uranium particle density per unit area, you know, per square kilometer, is approximately the same as 300 tons of depleted uranium being blown up in Iraq. So it's comparable. So that takes us to the health effects, okay? Because I know about the health effects in Iraq. That's something we studied. So we looked at the congenital malformations. We looked at the babies. We looked at all the horrible birth defects. We looked at the cancers, and we looked at the leukemias and all of that stuff. And we found a horrifyingly high level of genetic damage, which was also shown by the variation in the birth rates of different sexes, called the sex ratio at birth. The sex ratio at birth in every population in the world normally is 1,050 boys to 1,000 girls. That's a sort of standard birth ratio. And if it differs from that, there's been some genetic damage effect. It's affected the sperms or the eggs, or both. And in Iraq, what we found in Fallujah was that it was 800. Now, that's an astonishing astonishing anomaly in terms of the sex ratio. So something happened in Iraq, and the question is, what was it in Fallujah? And of course, everybody said it's uranium. They found the uranium there in the soil and so forth. I picked up the uranium bullets from the A-10 in the southern part of the desert, and I looked at the holes in the tanks and measured the radioactivity and blah blah blah. But in the case of Fallujah, we found the uranium in the hair of the women who had children with birth defects.
So what's the explanation for, and what which sex is it that starts to decline if there's radiation around in births?
Well, it depends upon the X chromosome. So you have a it's a bit complicated, so it's not easy to just explain it. But basically, what happens is that if you irradiate the woman, you have a spare. There's an XY chromosome situation which is not present in the woman into the same extent that it is in the men. And so what happens is, if you irradiate the women, you get an increased number of women born. If you irradiate the men, you get an increased number of men born. I mean, it's probably all on the internet, but it has to do with the X chromosome and the XY, you know, and the XX chromosome. XY.
Yeah. So are the Poles annoyed about this?
Sorry, the Poles. Well, I mean, the thing is that I've only just done this paper, and I've stuck it up on the internet, and I expect it'll get around. I sent it to a journal, but I don't suppose the journal will do anything with it. There's a sort of in the peer review literature at the moment, there's enormous control of these sorts of things. I mean, that's another thing which I.
Well, that is in the West, but surely, you know, you send it to a Russian or a Chinese journal, they'll take it, surely.
Well, the Russians have already done it. The Russians put something up about Klemnitsky that I wrote. The Russians are perfectly aware, and they said that the Poles have to watch out because they're going to get all these effects. I mean, that went up on Sputnik. When I do this stuff, I send it to the Russians, you know, and very often they publish it on Sputnik, or they or they interview me or whatever, you know, I've got a good relationship with the Russian media, with the Russian, you know, with RT and Sputnik. But I mean, I was mentioned recently by the beautiful Marianne Zakharova. They said Dr. Chris Busby found this and that. So it's not that they don't know. This was a press release from Zakharova in English.
No one's listening to Russians, not because they don't want to, because most of the Russian media has been blocked, amazingly. I mean, we did talk about neutron bombs a bit there. Can you just explain how they work? Is it just like a normal nuclear weapon? And also, what is there any evidence of what effects they have, or is this all kind of just theoretical stuff? Have they ever actually exploded one of these things in the atmosphere?
Yes. They have all of the major nuclear nations have got the neutron bomb, and they actually made the neutron bomb, and they've got them stockpiled. Okay, and in the 80s they were going to place them in Europe. Reagan was going to place neutron bombs in Europe, neutron missiles in Europe, but the Europeans said no. The bomb was invented by an Israeli guy, a Jewish guy called Sam Cohen, in I think 1980s, 1971, 1981, around about then. But the idea of the thing emerged long before that. The point about what we know about nuclear weapons, and this is a nuclear weapon, incidentally, is that they originally get the fission bomb. That's like they dropped on Hiroshima, and then they decided to make a hydrogen bomb or a fusion bomb, because you get much more energy out of fusion than you do out of fission. And fusion uses a fission material, fission of uranium, to produce an enormous amount of heat. And then what they do is they put in tritium and deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen and very heavy hydrogen, H2 and H3, as a lithium salt. And then under the influence of all that temperature, these things fuse together to form helium, and they give off a neutron. And this is a very high energy neutron, 14 million electron volts. And neutrons are normally in the hydrogen bomb, in the thermonuclear bomb, the ones they've got now, those ones, they encase them in uranium, in depleted uranium. So they make this all happen inside a sort of sphere of depleted uranium. And the depleted uranium reflects all the neutrons back. And also the temperature and the energy is so great that the depleted uranium itself goes off, bang. So it all goes up. So it makes an enormous bang. But what this guy Cohen figured out, or various people figured out, Lawrence Livermore, was that you can, if you don't encase them, what you get is you get a lot of neutrons below a certain kilotonnage. So if you make a very small bomb, and this is the key, because if it's a big bomb, the fission fusion effect is so great that the neutrons don't have as much of a relative effect. But if you make a small bomb, a kiloton, that sort of size, then the neutrons predominate in terms of exposure. So those neutrons fly out and they kill people, but they don't destroy material, because neutrons are neutral and they go through concrete and they go through iron, they go through walls, so anybody there will be instantly killed from the neutron flux, although the buildings will not be damaged. In 1969, this guy Cohen made a nuisance of himself trying to get them to use neutron bombs in Vietnam, because he said it would save a lot of lives, because all it would do is just kill the Vietnamese and not destroy the property. You know, it's a sort of what the Russians call what Yeltsin called a capitalist bomb. So in other words, it just killed people, but all of the buildings remained there. So this thing's been around a long time. The French had it. Cohen moved the Rand Corporation that he worked for when he developed this thing. They kicked him out because he was giving them a lot of trouble over this Vietnam stuff. So they sent him off.
It sounds to me as if it's because he was talking a bit too much publicly about it. He should have been keeping that under his hat.
Well, yes, it could be all sorts of reasons. Anyway, he went to Paris and then he got in with the French, and so he told them how to make a neutron bomb. So they made a neutron bomb. So they've got it. And then later on, when Reagan became president, he called Cohen to come back and develop the neutron bomb for America. So they developed loads of neutron bombs there, and they had neutron shells, neutron rockets, neutron missiles, you know, you name it. And the question is, did they use them? And certainly the Israelis have got it. I mean, if you look on the internet, in the Times in 1990 something or another, or maybe it was 2000, the Times of England had a big article about the Israeli neutron bomb, which was developed with the South Africans, and they tested it off southern end of South Africa. So they've got the neutron bomb. And the question is, have they used it? Everybody's got the neutron bomb. Don't worry about it. It's like a sort of complete secret, or else it's just been forgotten by people that these neutron bombs exist. They're very small. That's the point. It's a low yield bomb in terms of its like bang. It's not like a nuclear weapon. It's not like Hiroshima. It doesn't leave you with a kind of disastrous pile of rubble. It just kills people. And so how would you know if anyone used it? That's the point. How would you possibly know? Because all it does, it produces neutrons, and it produces what's called activation products. So if you fire neutrons at the ground, you get what's called activation products. So it's a whole range of very short-lived weird nuclides, you know, things that don't last very long, but they produce gamma radiation. So how would you know if someone had used a neutron bomb? Well, there are two things. So first of all, they produce enormous amounts of genetic damage. The neutrons have a relative biological effect of up to 100 times. So if you take a gamma ray dose of one, the neutron dose at the same energy would be 100 times. So you'd have an enormous amount of genetic damage from the use of a neutron bomb. But you wouldn't have much destruction of property. You get a lot of heat from it, so you'd get a flash that would burn people and burn vehicles and so on, you know, so there'd be a lot of heat involved. But the blast isn't very great, so it wouldn't knock buildings down or anything like that. So the way to look for the neutron activation products. And of course,
obviously for the genetic damage. But, you know, you're straying quite close to this whole area of particles and energy. You know, like this is a neutron. What's a gamma ray? What's an alpha? What a beta? What are these? Are they particles? Are they tiny little bits of atoms, or are they actually just high energy electromagnetic waves?
Well, it's generally that this is something that can be argued in all sorts of directions. I mean, any moving particle could be considered to be a wave. This was an idea developed in the 20s by Louis de Broglie. And so particles have a wavelength, and that's something else that I work on, but we won't go into that. It's a bit complicated, or it'll take a while to explain it, maybe some other time.
Yeah.
But most people will agree that a neutron is a particle. I mean, it has wave properties as well, but they will also support. So you can get neutron diffraction, for instance.
You seem to be sort of saying this stuff will go through concrete, but then when it hits a person, it will be absorbed by the person and cause damage.
It's not like a charged particle because it's got a zero charge. So what it does, it's quite different from gamma radiation and from alpha particles and so on. And electrons. So gamma radiation, when it hits you, it causes the ejection of electrons from atoms. Are molecules, and those electrons are what cause the problem. So the electrons are charged particles, and they whiz about the place, and as they bounce off things, they ionize them, and then you get all these ions, and the ions recombine and break things and so forth. So all of the gamma radiation and the beta particles from internal radiation that are beta decay nuclides, for example strontium 90, they all produce the same thing. They produce electrons. So the electrons whiz about inside you like a sort of bullet bouncing off things and causing ionization. And so that's what happens both with photon radiation, like light, which is like gamma rays and X-rays, and also it as a result of them, you get these electrons, and you also get electrons that get a part of a decay scheme for substances which are called beta emitters, okay? Put that to one side. What neutrons do is they don't work like that at all. Because they're neutral, they don't really interact with molecules in the same way. They don't knock electrons out. What they do is they hit them, and they're more likely to hit things where there are a lot of them. So they hit low. They sort of like billiard balls, and they punch their way into hydrogen atoms and low atomic number elements, you know, sodium and beryllium and boron, and those ones in the first period of the atomic So they're absorbed by all of those things. And when those things fly about, they produce a lot of energy and they bounce off things and they cause a lot of heat and so on. And how they and so what they do is they do ionization in a different way. But the way in which they do it is very, very much more powerful than the gamma rays in terms of their energy. So they have an ability to ionize tissue as a result of direct interaction. So they're absorbed by hydrogen. So you can absorb neutrons with paraffin wax, for example, which has got lots and lots of hydrogens in it. And you can absorb it with boron. They use boron as a neutron absorber in nuclear reactors in order to slow the reactor. So they have these control rods that go up and down. They're made of boron. So they control the neutron flux inside the reactor. Anyway, to come back to the point of how would we know if they were using it, the answer is simple. You would expect to see enriched uranium, because what happens is uranium contains U-238 and U-235, but also U-234, because when they extract the uranium, the enriched component, you know, the U-235 from the 238 from the mix, obviously, they're going to take out the lighter material, and 234 is even lighter than 235. So there's a fair bit of U-234 around, and when you hit that with a neutron, you knock it up to U-235. Neutron will add an atomic number to it, so it goes up to U-235. And according to my colleague, who is dead now, a chap called Emilio Della Guidici, who's a very famous Italian physicist who visited me in London shortly after I wrote that paper finding enriched uranium in Lebanon, and he came to see me to talk about this, and he said that what happens is that the uranium-238 gets kicked up to uranium-239, and that's a metastable, he said, I don't know, I'm not a nuclear physicist, but he said that's a metastable state of U-239 that drops back to U-235 with the emission of an alpha particle. But what I do know from what else I've studied is that U-239 goes to plutonium-239. So you would expect to find a little bit of plutonium in the mix as well as the enriched uranium. And in fact, indeed you do, because when I was on the depleted uranium oversight board, they reported, the Swiss who'd been measuring depleted uranium bullets said that they contained small amounts of plutonium-239, or not bullets, but the residue from the use of the bullets. So it's a very interesting area, but the most interesting part of it is that although I first discovered this enriched uranium in Lebanon and later in Gaza, they smuggled out, the Egyptians smuggled out some samples for me to measure. And I've written two papers on this, on the Lebanon one and on the Gaza one. And in 2017, in 2021, this is it. So last, a few years ago, there was a study in Nature. Nature's a very posh journal, of materials, of the gamma radiation measurements of materials in Gaza. By it's called Radiological Hazard Assessments of Radionuclides in Building Materials, Soils and Sands from the Gaza Strip and North Sinai Peninsula. And this is in Nature. And it's the main author is El Kader. This is an Egyptian woman, Mona M. Abd El Kader. And then there was a Japanese one, Taeko Shinonaga, and another Arab, Mohammed Sharif. And so they measured lots and lots of samples from Gaza to see what was in them. And what they found was that most of the samples had much more enriched uranium. I don't mean much more enriched uranium. I mean enriched uranium that was much more enriched than the stuff that I found in 2009. So I found enrichment ratios which were about, normally it's 138 is the normal ratio of U-238 to 235 in the environment if you dig some uranium out of the ground. 137.88 is the ratio. And this is the ratio that we used on the depleted uranium oversight board when we were measuring uranium in the soldiers who were concerned about DU. So that's 137.88 is normal. But these what I found when I used the, when I did the Gaza samples that were smuggled out to me through the tunnels in 2012, I found 112. So this is in slightly enriched, 112, 137.88 down to 112. But these guys, in their paper in 2021, found 12.9. Now, that's horrifyingly enriched. And they found it in all of the samples. That they found it in soil of Gaza, sand of Gaza, and they found it in, where we got here, recycled plaster and recycled concrete. Because they have to recycle all their building materials in Gaza because the Israelis won't let them have any building materials, so they recycle them. So
is there any possibility that this is naturally occurring stuff?
Totally impossible. Absolutely 1,000,000,000% impossible. All over the world, uranium the ratios which come down through evolution, from the beginning of the planet, have this signature, 137.88. If they don't have that, then they come from a nuclear reactor or from some other man-made scheme.
I mean, is there any clinical evidence of its use?
Yes, of course there is. There's a whole series of papers by that awful woman, Manduka. I shouldn't say that, should I? With that, by Paola Manduka, who I worked with sort of long ago. She came to talk to me about Fallujah. And she doesn't really believe that uranium is the cause. She's very woolly about whether uranium is the cause, and it could be because someone got to her and said, you can do all this stuff, but don't mention uranium. It's the elephant in the room. But she has measured uranium in all sorts of samples, and about five or six papers that she's written since 2014, mostly about congenital malformations in Gaza. So she's managed to get a load of money together to study congenital malformations in Gaza. And she blames all the pediatric outcomes on exposure to heavy metals, of which uranium is one. But she hasn't focused on the uranium. She's focused on barium, arsenic, cobalt, chromium, mercury, molybdenum, selenium, strontium, titanium, vanadium and uranium. And of course, anyone who has the slightest understanding of genetics will tell you that nearly all, none of those things, barium and arsenic and cadmium and all that, are a big deal when it comes to genetic damage, the sort of genetic damage that would cause the effects that she has measured, that she has seen. So, there are two things. First of all, there's the enriched uranium, which I say is a neutron weapon. And there's Manduka's various papers since 2014 about the effects, and the effects are there.
So you reckon she's been got at?
Yeah, I know she's been.
It's not that difficult to get at people, is it?
No.
Phone them up and you say, well, if you carry on like this, you're not going to get any funding or worse.
Well, I think it's worse than that. I think when we did Fallujah, she wanted to get hold of the samples, the hair samples that we got from the doctor, Samira. And by that time, it was clear to me that there was all sorts of switching going on with the samples because we measured the same sample. So I said to Samira, send her the sample and send me the sample as well, but just with a different code number. And so we got split samples, and the results she got for the samples were not the same as the ones we got for the samples when it came to uranium. So I know that she was got at. Now, whether later on she wasn't or whatever, who knows? And I'm not interested in too much in what she measured. What I am interested in is the fact that she detected she wrote a lot about the levels of congenital malformation that were occurring in Gaza.
Okay, so where has it come from?
Well, here's the point. It comes from a neutron bomb. That's what I now believe. So what I'm saying is that the Americans and the Israelis and now probably the Saudi Arabia people in Qatar, in Yemen, rather, are using uranium neutron bombs.
Why do you say uranium?
They're made of uranium. This is what this guy. This is how you make bombs.
The obvious question here, Chris, is surely that this is detectable if these things are used.
Yes, of course it is. It's detectable, but nobody detects it. Nobody goes and looks. After the Iraq War in 2003, the Americans refused to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency into Iraq for 6 months. I mean, that was very, very questionable, because you remember that the US went to war against Iraq on the basis that they had nuclear weapons, that they had weapons of mass destruction. So you would have thought that they'd let the IAEA in to do some measurements to see if they did have weapons of mass destruction. But no, they excluded them. They wouldn't let them in with any of their portable gamma spectrometers. That's the point. So how would they measure them? And where else? And who would know? The thing. So Ali Al-Kubaisi in 2006, after the Lebanon War, Professor Al-Kubaisi got in touch with me, and he said that there's a bomb crater in Qiyam, south of Lebanon, and it's radioactive. He didn't have a spectrometer, but he went with a Geiger counter. And he said, I waved the Geiger counter over the crater, and it gave 10 times background. And so I said, well, there's got to be something there. And so we've got to go and find it. So I asked my friend Di Williams to go out there. And so he flew out there and met Kubaisi, and they took some samples, and they measured the radiation, which by that time had gone down to about half that level. So it started off at 10 times. By that time, it was down to about 5 times, as I recall. Anyway, it went down over a period of time. And so they brought some samples back. Di brought some samples back. I had them tested in two different laboratories by two different methods. So the first method was alpha spectrometry, which was done by a friend of mine in North Wales, who had a big laboratory in Bangor, a big radiation measuring laboratory. He did alpha spectrometry. He said, yeah, enriched. And then I also sent them to Harwell, that by that time I was working with, and had them measured by inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. And they said, yes, enriched. And both of their different methods gave pretty much the same answer, about 112, 116. And so he went out. So then there was a big fuss about all of this. And the UN said they were going to send somebody to check it all out. And they sent a team of people. The Greenpeace sent some guy called Hank van der Keur from Netherlands. And he said he couldn't find anything. And by the time the UN came and Di went out there the second time to take, we were going to take joint samples. So he split some samples. One went to the UN, UNEP, and the other we brought back. And we still found enriched uranium, but UNEP said that they didn't find enriched uranium. But I don't trust UNEP at all. I mean, UNEP originally said when we went to Kosovo that there was no depleted uranium there. They sent a team out there and they said, oh, well, they didn't find any depleted uranium. Well, I found depleted uranium. And so I went out on the television, on Japanese television, because they paid for me to go out there, Nippon TV. And so we were the first people to show that the US were using depleted uranium weapons in Kosovo.
I suppose you're up against this constant problem is that, you know, a bit like, well, it's various stories. I'm thinking immediately about MH370, the plane that disappeared. Well, if the military have been involved in taking it, then there's a massive cover-up. And even all the civil society groups that are supposed to oversee this stuff are just told to keep their mouths shut.
Yes, well, I mean, I thought quite a lot about whether I should say anything about this business of neutron bombs. Because, you know, I've got this sort of reputation which has been spun by whoever it is that runs the internet, you know, Google and so on, of being some kind of mad person. But in the end, and so obviously if I'm going to come out and I say they've been using neutron bombs, the Israelis have been like neutron bombs, they're going to say, well, you know, this is just total crazy, now crazy Busby and all his crazy conspiracy theories. But my question to them is that, well, you have to explain why there's this paper in Nature that shows highly enriched uranium in all of the samples they measured in Gaza. And that isn't Busby. That's, you know, three researchers who measured this stuff, and they give you the answers and all the statistics are there and all the rest of it. So you explain where the enriched uranium came from, because the only possible place it could come from is somewhere, something to do with nuclear material, and man-made nuclear material. And so you could say, and in fact, my friend Dai has suggested that that what they do is they drop enriched uranium on the ground in order to compensate for the depleted uranium that they've been using, so that it comes out normal and nobody can measure it. But to be honest, I think that's absurd. I mean, this is like trying to kill your using enriched uranium by dropping it on people is like trying to kill people by dropping diamonds on them. It's very expensive stuff.
Enriched uranium is, yeah. But I mean, what about the samples? When you're going around collecting samples, do you go around equipped with a Geiger counter, finding a hot spot and taking that piece of soil,
or you have to, if you're going to look for this stuff on the ground, you have to use a scintillation counter, because you have to look for the beta radiation from the depleted uranium. You get the daughters, the thorium and the protoactinium, are both beta emitters. So you look for beta. Beta has a range in air of about a meter. And so what you do is you trail this scintillation counter about 6 inches above the ground, and suddenly it goes mad. And then you look to see on the ground what's there, and you take a sample. You're not likely to find it with a Geiger counter, because they're very, very, unless you've got pure uranium, the amount of gamma radiation coming off it is not so great. Of course, you've got pure radiation. There's a lot of gamma coming off it from the thorium-234 and the protoactinium-234 gammas. The protoactinium-234 gamma is a particularly powerful one. It's 1,000 keV. It's one MeV decay. There's not much of it. It's 0.7%. But still, if you've got a lump of uranium there, 0.7% of it is quite a lot of gamma. So that's what you do. So in Kosovo and in Iraq, I wondered about the place with a scintillation counter. I mean, the Irish government bought me a scintillation counter for some work that I was doing on Sellafield. They're quite expensive things, about £2,000 to get one of those. It has a very, very thin window, and when the beta particles or alpha particles hit it, they cause a little flash of light on the inside, and that's picked up by a photomultiplier and amplified. And then you get a little bleep. And in fact, the one I've got has got a discrimination system. So it gets you get a click, 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 click from the gammas. But if you get an alpha, it goes beep. So you get click, 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 beep, click, click, beep, beep, click, 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 beep, like that. Okay, that's the sound it makes. It's quite a cool machine. Anyway, it's in England now.
Well, what about? I mean, talking about Gaza, we have to visit this conflict that's going on at the moment. We've just had, literally today, the resumption of bombing by the Israelis. I mean, apparently, according to the BBC, the war is continuing now, but it doesn't really seem to be much about warring. It seems to be more about bombing from the air.
Yes, well, why would the? I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, I've been looking at war strategy. I know, isn't it horrifying? Looking at Moltke and all these sort of Clausewitz and so forth. I mean, it seems to me that all you have to do if you want to destroy the Palestinians is to bomb them with materials that destroy their genetic their genetic, you know, makeup. I mean, we know that's happened already. Because
don't the Israelis want the real estate? I mean, that's part of the deal here. Is that
of course they want they can rebuild all that stuff. That's not a problem. I mean, they can rebuild all that stuff. So they're doing both. They're smashing it flat, and they're producing, and they're dropping uranium, you know, neutron bombs on the place. I'm sure that's what they're doing. I mean, the Israelis. I mean, I used to say that United States is a psychosis, but the Israelis are total psychosis. I mean, they have said that they see this like Saul and the Amalekites, you know, David and the Amalekites. In fact, their neutron bomb is called David's Sling. How about that? The one that they've got, their neutron bomb, they called it David's Sling. Yeah? Okay. So they don't give a damn about it. They want to wipe out all these people because, as far as they're concerned, they're non-human. They're just Arabs, you know. They're Amalekites. They're the devil. They're going to be wiped out, all of them. That's what they want to do. And everybody stands by and watches it happen. In particular, the Americans stand by and watch it happen. Or even, as I understand lately from people that have contacted me, is that they're increasing their supply of weapons to Israel to try and effect this destruction of the Palestinians in Gaza and drive them out. So they all go and live in Egypt, or they live in the desert, or they live in the sea.
How can they actually get out?
Well, they can, I mean, from time to time, the various ones do get out. But the problem is there's nowhere for them to go. I mean, the Egyptians don't want them. So the answer is to destroy them. The answer is to destroy them, and that's what they're doing. That's their plan.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people would be very, skeptical about your saying that they're going to use neutron weapons, even if there is some evidence of that, because you'd be left with a kind of radiation wasteland, and those beautiful shores along there, the Israelis would be looking at that real estate to redevelop it, to sell it, you know, kind of classic redevelap. Disaster capitalism.
Tony, let's get one thing absolutely straight. A neutron bomb does not leave any nuclear waste, okay? It just leaves behind uranium particles, that's all. And uranium particles are not good, but they're not nuclear waste. They don't have the same properties as if they like Hiroshima, you know, where the place was sort of radioactive with strontium-90 and cesium-137 and all these fission products. And in any case, the problem is that, and this is why I do this attack on the radiation risk model, is that they swallow all this radiation risk model. They think that the radiation risk model is correct. They don't think uranium causes any effects. Never mind about the neutrons. Of course, they know the neutrons cause effects. But once the neutron bomb has gone bang and destroyed the genetic material of the people that are there, that's it, you know. There's nothing, no downstream effect, except there's some uranium particles. But they don't think uranium particles are harmful. They really don't. Their model says they're not harmful. The generals say they're not harmful, and nobody in the West believes that they're harmful. You have the Royal Society saying they're safe. They have all these bogus, dishonest spin doctor scientists who tell the government what they want to hear, and so they give uranium weapons away to Ukraine. And when someone complains about them, and when Putin complains about them, they say, oh, it's just nonsense, they're perfectly harmless, no problem, I would eat them for breakfast, and all this stuff. It's just complete smoke and mirrors, really.
I mean, it is useful to be talking about nuclear weapons. I noticed just a couple of days ago the United Nations has warned that nuclear war is at its highest risk since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is reported in some countries, and Pakistan reported it, not being reported on the BBC News. But, you know, as we're discussing all this, we're being told by the UN this is more likely than any time since Nagasaki and Hiroshima. There's this big meeting going on down in the Middle East, funnily enough, in Dubai. It's called COP28, exactly, yeah. So with King Charles, David Cameron, amazingly sort of resurrected from the grave, and Rishi Sunak all vying to get down there first in their private jets.
Well, I mean, let's not get started on global warming. As far as I'm concerned, the whole media, the whole of the sort of, if you like, the central gravity of understanding of the situation is wrong. That's my position on all of this. That the dangers are coming from areas which are not talked about very much. And if there's one message I want to get out in your talk, in this interview that we have now, is that we already are in a nuclear war. We have been in a sort of nuclear war since the 60s. And the increase in cancer in the world, and the increase in congenital malformations, and the decrease in fertility, and all of the loss of populations, the loss of fish populations and bird populations and insect populations, and more or less the entire shambles that we're in at the moment on spaceship Earth, is something which is a consequence primarily of the release of radioactivity to the environment. And what we see now is the use of the neutron bomb, which for many years was believed to be the worst and most terrible weapon ever invented by anybody. And now it's being used. So that's my message to the planet, is that we have evidence that it's being used, and that evidence is in the uranium enrichment in areas where bombs have been used, which produce these big black clouds and huge explosions. And then, you know, kill people mysteriously. And later on, then they have this downstream effect of cancer and congenital malformation and so on. So this is what we have to get out. We have to get out the fact that they're using in Gaza, and they have used in Gaza since 2009, the neutron bomb, which everybody knows that they have.
Yeah, David Sling. But look, you and I have got some bizarre connections. First of all, through Langley Park School and the Wellcome Trust, back in the 1970s, you were there, I was there, just over the other side of the fence in the school, in the secondary school, learning about this from Ted Dalby and Martin Black, our two physics A-level tutors, plus also being involved, you know, it's almost like sort of planets that sort of pass each other from time to time. In this George Monbiot's The Land Is Ours, and it's the thing that he kind of started, and the diggers from the English Civil War really saying actually that the real environmental, I mean, you know, both of us are sort of environmentalists that have been kind of sidelined by the mainstream XR style environmental movement. And you know, in those days we used to talk about land being the most important thing. You were doing all your work on low level radiation and showing that the nuclear threat was still there and still active. You know, never mind there were no Aldermaston marches anymore from the 1950s, when people first realized that little places like Corsham in Wiltshire, where we're going to be incinerated with a Soviet hydrogen bomb because there was some kind of bunker underneath it, and people were getting very, very upset about all that in those days. But now the whole thing seems to have been, you know, our stuff was through, you know, land and social justice, the idea that everyone needs land. Let's just make sure everyone's got some land. We've got something like 50 million acres. We just dish it out and have some sort of land reform in the UK. You know, we've both been sort of elbowed out, and there's this new environmental thing, which is all about climate change. So I do want you to say, if you don't mind, what you make of this. It seems to me like a hijacking of the environmental movement and a total diversion from the very real prospect of a World War III breaking out just down the road in Gaza.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I told the Green Party in the 90s that this whole climate change thing was invented by the nuclear industry in order to destroy China. They wanted to bring in these carbon tokens, you know, so that you had to stop people burning a lot of fossil time. The Chinese were that was their primary source of energy, and they had a lot of coal, so they were using it all. And so I think it came in as a sort of idea to promote nuclear as the energy of the future and so on. I said that at the time. Now, clearly there is a change in the climate, and it could well be that it's a consequence of too many cars and too much carbon dioxide and so on. But having done the sums on the carbon dioxide, I'm not entirely convinced that the carbon dioxide is a big deal. But the use of energy is certainly a big deal. I mean, just all of these things producing kilowatts all the time of energy are going to heat up the atmosphere. Or it could well be that this is a cyclical event. I mean, if you look at the cyclical events in terms of the temperatures measured since the beginning about 1,000 years ago, there's a series of cycles which sometimes they all come together. So as far as I'm concerned, the jury is out on that. The scientific jury is out on that. So I don't go along with the idea that this climate change is a consequence of carbon dioxide. This is just a correlation.
Well, there's a couple of things, aren't there, as well in the background. One of them is this concept that if there were a war, particularly one of the first things to be hit would be all of the imports of the massive amount of oil in those tankers heading over from the Middle East. None of that would be able to get through. So that there is, you know, a potential agenda there in making sure that we're no longer dependent on any of these imports. You know, what do you make of that?
Well, I can tell you that if we don't have imports to the British Isles, then everybody will starve. I mean, that's it. The thing is that the land area of the British Isles is not enough to sustain its population. It wasn't enough to sustain its population in the Second World War, never mind about now, where you've got like a lot more people. I mean, what was it, 65 million people now, and in the war it was about 40 something million. So and of course the other thing is the distribution of this of food and fuel and so on is dependent on the existence of food and fuel. You know, so the thing is all connected. We're on spaceship Earth, but there's nobody on the bridge deciding what to do. Everybody's trying to grab what they can and run off and hide and sort of like make as much money as possible before it all falls to pieces, and which it is doing. It is falling to pieces. So if I go back to the 1950s and 60s when I was reading science fiction, most of what the science fiction people, clever people, predicted, we can see now it's happening. And that's why I'm in Latvia with about 30 acres of land, you know, two-thirds of that are trees, which I can cut down, you know, in sustainable way and feed onto the fires and keep warm. And there's enough arable land here to grow things and so on. So that's the best I can do, really. I mean, I've always been a survivalist. As far as the Green Party is concerned, I've given up on them. I mean, the thing that did it for me was Annalena Baerbock in Germany. I mean, I've always had no time for the German Greens. They're all a bunch of fascists. But the English Greens are basically pathetic and pointless. They embrace ideas and directions which are really rather meaningless. I mean, you and I don't know whether you are, but I'm an old commie, really. I sort of come in at the point of view from each according to his abilities to each according to their needs, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and so that was one of the most important sentences ever written in the Communist Manifesto.
It's called social justice. It's making sure that everyone has the same basic, rights as whether it's access to food, water, shelter, all these kind of things. And that the purpose of government is to take from those who've got too much and give it to those that don't have enough.
Yes, I agree with you. So it's not surprising that our paths have crossed over the years. But I have to say that yesterday I'd had enough of it and I resigned from the Green Party. I said, that's it. I'm not paying my subscription anymore.
The other thing, I suppose, is having a mixed economy where the government actually runs the infrastructure and allows genuine entrepreneurs to go out and innovate.
Well, all of those things are true, Tony, but I mean, my feeling about it, and people are always asking me at meetings, which I don't go to anymore, incidentally, because I think I'm pointless, what you know, that I'm some sort of greenie that advocates going back to the horse and cart and so forth, and you know, not using the fruits of science to you know, for the good of mankind. But that just isn't true. I mean, the problem is that we manufacture too many useless things, okay? So enormous amounts of energy, if you like, from nuclear power or from wherever, goes into making products which nobody needs or wants. This sort of mad capitalism where you and then you sell this stuff. You use a lot more energy to sell this stuff to people through television, and you know, everybody has to have one of these and they must have one of those and so on. You walk down any high street, look through a window, and 95% of what you see is pointless, useless crap. Okay, but somebody's made it, and somebody else has advertised it, and somebody's hiring a shop to put it all in the window and attract somebody else to come in and buy it so that they have to work in order to make money to do that and so on. This is like a 90% pointless operation. And as Yablokov said to me when I first met him in Oxford in 1998, he said that 90% of everything in the world is military spending. And I believe that's true. I believe that's true. And that all adds as GNP, you know, so your GDP and your GNP is military spending. It's absurd.
A perfect example is nuclear power. Massive amounts of money being ploughed into that to produce, at the end of the day, very expensive electricity, but these little cubes of plutonium.
Yes, so that you can drop bombs on people. And the other thing is about vehicles and transport. I mean, look at vehicles and transport. Do we need all these different cars or burning fuel all the time? We can have a decent system of universal transport. And then you don't need all these cars. That's it. You just get rid of a lot of them.
But well, you're roughly the same age as me. I grew up in a world where you paid tuppence for a bus ticket. You could go anywhere you wanted. You could go up to London on the train very easily, also extremely cheaply. Every 15 minutes there was another train, and people just didn't need cars.
No, that's right. And then Thatcher destroyed the railway. Oh, no, whoever it was. No, it wasn't in the 60s. It was Beeching. Anyway, so they destroyed the railways. All the little branch lines disappeared and so on. the point about the railways is, like the post office and like a lot of water and all the rest of it, is that these are social, these are socially cohesive operations. You know, they are people-centered things. You know, you don't have a railway between A and B because you need to make money. You have a railway between A and B because it's something that the people want and they can go from A to B.
Anyway, the one person who's been, you know, involved with this whole COP28 right the way from 1992, the Rio Earth Summit, is King Charles. He's now taken on a very political role. He sees himself as the saviour of the environment, saviour of the world, even. And, you know, I just wonder what you make of these sustainable development goals. A lot of people, commentators, are articulating what many people feel, that there is this kind of war on the motorist, that people have been basically driven out of public transport into their cars because of privatisation and all sorts of other reasons, basically because it's cheaper. They can only get to work reliably by using a car. And these sustainable development goals that have been developed by the whole COP28 process and the UN, what they've done is they're just trying to kind of level out the planet. So they have to force the developed world to go backwards in a way, to get rid of its use of energy, which it's come to rely on. So what do you make of this sort of whole the process that's been going on since 92 over in Rio, which King Charles started?
My position is one that I more or less articulated, you know, which is that the sort of neo-capitalist or neo-conservative, neo-liberal system that we find ourselves in now is a massive disaster in terms of spaceship Earth. It's just a dog-eat-dog kind of jungle. And some new political approach to all of this is necessary. Otherwise, it's just going to implode. And that's, in fact, what it's doing. It's imploding. So we've got wars in Ukraine. We've got wars in... These are basically resource wars. And we will have resource wars. And if nobody can step in and do anything about it, these resource wars will eventually end up in nuclear exchanges. And even if they don't, they will end up in horrifying Victorian-type starvation situations like the 30s. And I saw this coming years ago. So I thought, what I've got to do is get out, find myself somewhere where I can grow things, and hide. It's more or less what I'm doing. But of course, you can't really hide.
What they call a prepper, isn't it? Anyway, look, before we round up, you know, I mentioned the Wellcome Trust. They are the British equivalent of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the notorious Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, these massive depositories of wealth, which are used for enormous amounts of political influence. For example, now the major funder of the World Health Organization, which is supposed to be an intergovernmental body. So can you just say what you were up to at the Wellcome Trust, the Burroughs Wellcome, as it used to be called, down in West Wickham near Eden Park Station, and what you make of Wellcome Trust itself?
Yes. Well, I left Wellcome for the reason that they altered their whole structure from Burroughs Wellcome and Company into the Wellcome Foundation Limited. That they did that when I was there, and they had to have an Act of Parliament to do it, and they did. They got an Act of Parliament, and their argument was that they weren't competitive because under Henry Wellcome's will, all of the profits from their research and their production of important drugs that saved people had to be ploughed back into research. And they said, well, this isn't good enough because, you know, we're going to have advertising and we're going to have to do all sorts of things that didn't exist at the time of Henry Wellcome's death. And so we're going to change it all. And so they did change it all. And what happened was that my colleague, a chap called Barrett, had developed a drug for South American sleeping sickness, which was very, very effective. But Wellcome at that time was very big in tropical medicine. We were probably the biggest drug company for tropical medicine. And they said, well, we're not going to market your drug. We're just going to patent it and put it on the shelf so nobody else can patent it. And we'll continue to use the drug that we've got, which was not as good and also has lots of horrifying side effects. And the reason is that the people who have South American seeking sickness, you know, don't have any money. So we can't make any money out of it. So we're not going to take this any further. And he'd spent like years and years, 10 years developing this stuff. And, you know, he was just coming to the end of his time there. He was an old guy, 65 or something, you know, and he came around with a bottle of champagne and we sat down and drank it all and thought and talked about all of this stuff. And I thought, well, fuck this. I'm not going to work for these arseholes anymore. So I left. I walked out. Left all my books, everything. What was I doing there? What I was doing there was very, very interesting. They gave me more or less unlimited money because they decided I was a very clever kind of mad guy, genius or whatever. You know, they decided that. I'm not saying I am. And they gave me more or less infinite money to buy things, not for my wages, incidentally. My wages were not great. But if I wanted to buy something, I could buy it. I could just say, yeah, I'll have one of those. Thank you very much. And they would deliver it. And we'd pay, you know, 20,000 quid or something. That was a lot of money in those days, 1973, 72, 71. So, and I was on all sorts of committees. And the idea was that my main thing was designing drugs, figuring out how drugs worked at a molecular level. I'm a physical chemist. And what I was doing was looking, using spectroscopies of various sorts, nuclear magnetic resonance, infrared, ultraviolet, you know, thermodynamic methods, whatnot, to look at how drugs work at the cell level. And I pretty much figured out how drugs work at the cell level, but it wasn't the way they thought. But anyway, I'd had enough of these people, so I left. It was a very interesting time, and the people I worked with were very clever people. I don't know, geniuses. I'm not so sure about the concept of genius, but certainly they were clever people, and it was a fantastic time. And then shortly after I left, maybe a few years after I left, the Americans just scooped it all up and took it off to America, and then they sold off Langley Park, and that was the end of it.
Maybe you can just clear one thing up that us school kids used to talk about, because you could, if you look through the fence, you could just. You could just about see two objects next to this massive, beautiful manor house surrounded by sheep and cows, livestock, which they were doing these experiments on of various sorts and trying drugs out on, I suppose.
That's right.
But next to this manor house was this kind of little annex with a massive water tower and a giant chimney. And we used to speculate that maybe... because we all knew that there was genetic modification stuff going on in there. It was well known that the water tower was to flush away the various weird creatures that had appeared, these mutants, flush them down the drain. And if they couldn't flush them down the drain, then they could stick them in the chimney and burn them.
I think they burned them. But there were lots and lots of sacrifices of animals. I mean, pharmacology there. I used to work with pharmacology. And that was another reason that I hated all that stuff, is because what they would do is they would test their drugs on animals, you know, rats and rabbits and guinea pigs and monkeys and sheep and so on. And when they finished, of course, they pharmacologists are extremely blasé about life. I mean, I remember going to one. I was working with this guy. I can't remember his name now. Johnson, that was it. And he was a pharmacologist, and so they had these rats, and they were putting a syringe into the stomach of the rat. We were working on these substances which reduce stomach acid. So the rat would be pegged out, and he'd have a needle put into his stomach to form a thing called a Heidenheim pouch. And they would be measuring acid release after they'd injected various substances which were supposed to reduce acids. And anyway, so there we are. So there's the experiment. So I go in there, and he's got this animal there, and he's just setting it all up. And then he does it wrong. So the needle doesn't go in quite the right place. And he said, oh, fuck. And then he pulls the needle out and throws the rat, bleeding and everything, into the waste paper basket. Or into, not a waste paper, but a waste rat basket, I suppose you'd call it. Anyway, the damn thing was still alive, of course, scrabbling about and squealing and so forth, you know. I mean, that's the sort of thing they used to do. I'm more or less against animal experiments. It's horrifying. Most of them are unnecessary and pointless and horrible, just horrible. So I didn't want to be involved in all of that stuff.
Was there ever any kind of vivisection protest there?
Yeah, of course. Loads and loads of vivisection. That's what they did. That's more or less what they did.
But no protests against it, no?
No, the thing is that people can, you know, if you're in the right place, in the right group think outfit, you just accept that that's what you do. You don't think, oh my God, maybe these rats, you know, are in pain, and or maybe I should this or maybe I should that. It's just you're surrounded by people who all think that what the rats are for is for doing experiments to see whether some drug works or doesn't. You know, that's what they're for. They're not animals. They're not like, I mean, I used to say about all this stuff that's, I mean, if you take a mobile phone, you know, take the best mobile phone that we can buy. We go out and buy, I know what they call them now, an iPhone or something, 15 or whatever the hell. And you look at all the inside and everyone says, ooh, wow, and then you have to pay a 1,500 quid for one of these things, right? But you get a rat, what's it going to cost you? Like, I mean, five euros, 10 euros or something like that. The complexity and wonderfulness of a rat, just a rat or a rabbit or any of these things, it's just, you know, millions of times more wonderful than an iPhone. And yet they're worthless. You know, you can just rip open their stomach and measure the acid in it. And then if you don't like the way in which you did that, you throw it in the bin. And then all these animals then go along and get roasted in that incinerator that you said with the chimney.
Yeah, I suppose they would. Yes. Yeah. So you got a little puff of smoke at the end of every day's work.
Yeah, so. That's right. So every time you do a few experiments, you know, all the rats go in the bin, or the mice, or the chicken, or whatever they work on, you know, guinea pigs and whatnot, you know, and there's all these dead animals in a bin. You've got to do something with them. So you have an incinerator, just like Hitler did.
Well, so it's not so far from the truth that what we were seeing through that changing fence.
No, I don't think, I mean, I didn't recall at that time that anybody was doing genetic mutation experiments. I don't think that at the time I was there, they didn't have they didn't know enough about genetics at that time to do that sort of thing. But I mean, of course it's possible. I mean, but I mean, I wasn't very much involved with those people. I was involved with the pharmacology people, though. I did a lot of work with them.
Okay, Chris. Well, look, you know, you put me in mind, and I mentioned our physics masters who were teaching us a bit about nuclear physics just the other side of the chain link fence in the science block at Langley Park. For those people who have been, you know, listening, following some of this nuclear physics, have you got any recommendations for Christmas books for people to sort of get up to speed on some of this? Because it is pretty complicated, but it's absolutely essential if you're going to critique it, as you've been doing. For people to actually get their heads around, you know, the neutrons, the isotopes, the effects of these things, that, you know, how to measure them, etc.
Well, you can't do better, in my opinion, if you're taking the position that I take, that you'd have to get to one of my books. And there's still a few of them left. You can order them from Richard Bramall or from me, and I'll get them posted off to you. The two books of Wings of Death, that's the most important one. That's 1995. That was funded by the Roundtrees, and we've still got some of those left over. And the other one is Wolves of Water, which is more about the epidemiology, and it's got a lot about uranium weapons. And all of that stuff is still true. If you go and get a physics book, you know, from, like, as a physics book about radiation, you will be taught a load of nonsense, really. You'll be taught the basic stuff, but it won't mean anything. So you're best off getting my Wings of Death or Wolves of Water. And so they can order those from Green Audit, from Christo at greenaudit.org, or from the Low Level Radiation Campaign, LLRC.org. He's still got a load of those. Wings of Death. It's a good book. I read it again recently, and lots of people have said it's a good book. It's sort of chatty and entertaining, but gives you the bare bones of radiation and how it works and how it kills and epidemiology and all the rest of it. It's quite fun, that book.
I mean, you've done a lot of advice to governments, etc., over the years. Would you agree with the UN's assessment of the present danger of nuclear war?
Yeah, I would.
Dr. Chris Busby from Latvia, thanks very much for joining us again.
Okay, Tony. Cheers.